Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's endorsement of Hillary Clinton shortly after his White House meeting with Bernie Sanders, who pledged to work with Clinton to unify the Democratic Party and defeat Donald Trump. Peter Dreyer, Distinguished Professor of Politics at Occidental College, joins us to discuss his latest article at the Huffington Post, Let Bernie Be Hillary, which points out that in 2008, it took Hillary Clinton a while to accept defeat and embrace Barack Obama. And we will also examine a five-point plan for Sanders that Peter Dreyer recently wrote in The American Prospect that urges Sanders supporters to help Bernie build a progressive legacy. Then we look into whether or not Donald Trump actually has a presidential campaign and speak with David Graham, a staff writer for The Atlantic, about his latest article at The Atlantic, There Is No Trump Campaign. We will discuss not just the lack of a national Trump campaign and no state-level campaign director in the critical state of Ohio, but no fundraising organization which, with a campaign in chaos, is causing donors to close their checkbooks on a candidate who is tearing the Republican Party apart, doesn't follow conservative orthodoxy, and seems to have no idea what he's doing on a day-to-day basis. Then finally, we will follow on from Bernie Sanders' remarks today at the White House after his meeting with President Obama, where he called for statehood for the District of Columbia, pointing out that there are fewer people in his state of Vermont and in Wyoming than there are in the District of Columbia. Anise Jenkins, the executive director of the Stand Up for Democracy in D.C. Coalition, joins us to discuss the outrageous fact that the 700,000 American citizens who live in our nation's capital suffer under a regime of taxation without representation, which was the condition that helped spark the American Revolution and led to the Declaration of Independence in 1776. And joining us now is Peter Dreyer, who is the E.P. Clapp Distinguished Professor of Politics and Chair of the Urban and Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College. His latest book is The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Let Bernie Be Hillary. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Dreyer.
Thanks.
And explain the joke, if you will, Let Bernie Be Hillary.
Well, you know, understandably, Sanders is now, you know, licking his wounds and celebrating his triumphs and trying to figure out what to do next. And he's getting a lot of criticism for not immediately jumping on the Hillary bandwagon and endorsing her. But in fact, 8 years ago, at the end of the 2008 Democratic primary campaign, Hillary Clinton did the same thing. She, rather than give a concession speech on the last night of the primaries after she had clearly lost the nomination, didn't have enough delegates. Instead, she went to a speech in New York City at Baruch College, and she said she needed a few days to consider her options. She said that her differences with Obama were still considerable. She talked about all the supporters she had and so forth, and it looked like she was just on an ego trip. And then, you know, 2 days later after that speech, she met with Obama. And then on June 7th, 2008, she conceded and endorsed him, and the rest is history. And, you know, obviously as part of the negotiation between her and Obama about when the endorsement would come and how enthusiastic and how much she'd campaign for him, there were some conversations about what she would get out of it. And I'm not saying that's where she became the vice president. The Secretary of State. There were people that thought she wanted to be the vice president. So it's completely reasonable that Bernie Sanders has to take some time to think about what his next move is. And, you know, he's already signaled he's going to embrace and endorse Hillary Clinton after today's meeting with the president. And the real question for him is, what did he get for the tens of millions of people that supported him in terms of the platform, in terms of getting rid of the current head of the Democratic National Committee, in terms of Hillary Clinton's priorities, in terms of when he speaks at the convention? Does he have a voice in any of the cabinet secretaries that she appoints when she becomes president? And what kind of movement he's going to build after the election to hold her accountable? And he's got to think through all that. And let's give him a few days before we start, raining on his parade.
And what do you think? So you don't think he rained on her parade, because that's exactly what she did back in 2008 with Barack Obama, right?
Absolutely. She rained on his parade, and people are saying Bernie's raining on her parade. He's just taking some time to think it through, you know, give the guy a chance. You know, a year ago, he was a relatively little-known senator from a tiny state who had a small following among lefties, but he wasn't a national figure. And, you know, his campaign has gone way beyond what he thought a year ago. And he's, you know, it's hard to concede defeat. It's hard to, realize you've lost. It's agonizing. So he needs some time to figure out what to do next. And Hillary had to do the same thing 8 years ago, and so there's no reason to, you know, I mean, she's not attacking him, but lots of her supporters are attacking Sanders for not jumping on her bandwagon right away. And I think they should, you know, back off.
Chill, right?
Yeah.
So, Peter Dreier, then, what do you think? Obviously, the big conversation will happen later between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Although Sanders said today he would support her and work to unify the Democratic Party and defeat Donald Trump. So what do you think transpired in the meeting with Obama?
Well, I think, you know, Obama is basically, I assume, I wasn't there, but, you know, I assume he said the same thing that that he probably said to Hillary, you know, 8 years ago. Let's bring the party together. You know, I'll try to make sure that you get a speaking gig at the convention where you get at prime time. But more importantly, it's about the platform. It's about making sure that that Hillary Clinton makes raising the minimum wage and free college tuition and so forth her top priorities. You know, in some ways, you know, Bernie Sanders has already won the war of ideas. I mean, Hillary Clinton ran this campaign, her campaign, on his issues. And so now it's a question of, you know, how does Sanders both embrace her and endorse her and get his followers to support her and vote for her, at the same time realizing that they still have differences and that after the election's over and after she's the president and he's the chair of the Senate Budget Committee, that his grassroots political revolution that he wants to build is still in motion and still putting pressure on the Congress and on President Clinton to live up to the promises she made during the campaign and to push her to the left as president the way he pushed her to the left as a candidate.
Well, today, of course, the other person who's been mentioned both as a possible vice presidential candidate on the ticket with Hillary Clinton and as somebody that could help bring the Democratic Party together, Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren, made an extraordinary powerful speech today. She's unquestionably a rising star. And of course, as you point out, Bernie Sanders just attracted thousands and thousands of young people to rallies, more than anybody in this campaign. And that's is an interesting challenge, is it not, Peter Dreier? How do you get the young people to stay engaged in politics? Because even here in California, where there was a number of rallies that Bernie had with the young people in attendance, a lot of those people didn't vote. They went to the rallies, but they didn't vote. I mean, the Sanders people expected more votes than they got, particularly from the young, and it just didn't happen. So that is a real challenge, is it not, to keep young people engaged, but also to get them to vote. Now, notwithstanding the fact that we have the most antiquated, backward voting systems in the entire Democratic world, it's an absolute disgrace. And later in the program, we'll be talking about the District of Columbia, where you can't even vote, and which Bernie Sanders today at the White House called for statehood for District of Columbia. We'll be covering that later. But just touch on that challenge to not just inspire young people to get into politics, but make sure they vote.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two things going on here. Number one, I don't think Elizabeth Warren should be the vice presidential nominee for two reasons. One, she's too valuable in the Senate as a voice of progressive politics, and I think she'd be muzzled politically if she were the vice president. She'd have to toe the party line of Clinton, and she's, you know, to the left of Clinton. Secondly, she is from a state, Massachusetts, with a Republican governor, which means that he would appoint a Republican to replace her, and the Democrats have to take back the Senate, and if they win back the Senate by 1, 2, 3, or 4 margin vote, they'll still need Massachusetts. So I think that's a strategic and political mistake. In terms of young voters, I don't agree that they're not going to come out to vote, because in the current election and the primary season, a lot of them were enthusiastic about Bernie, but they weren't voting against Trump. They were voting or not voting between Bernie and Hillary. But I think the best energizer, the most motivator for young people to vote is not only Bernie out there on the hustings, campaigning vigorously for Hillary and doing lots of events on college campuses and really mobilizing his troops, getting a lot of his supporters and staff people to be hired by the Clinton campaign to work in her election. But also you've got Donald Trump, who's out there saying these outrageous things which offend liberals and progressives and all kinds of Americans. And I think that the turnout among young people in this election will be higher than it even was in 2008 when they turned out for Obama. So you've got Bernie out there campaigning, telling people, okay, you don't necessarily agree with everything Hillary Clinton's for, but, you know, the alternative is Donald Trump. And so I think there'll be a big turnout, but it really depends on the infrastructure in, you know, creating the campaign infrastructure to literally knock on doors, and in the case of young people, get people on their texts and cell phones and motivate them to come out to vote. And I think that's going to happen after the convention's over and after the party's united and after Bernie has endorsed and starts campaigning for Hillary. I think there'll be a handful of ultra-lefty nihilists that will say, you know, still say that Bernie should run as a Green Party candidate or that Hillary's as bad as Trump, like Susan Sarandon said, which was absolutely crazy. But 95% of Bernie's supporters aren't that crazy, and they'll realize that, you know, a Trump presidency would be a disaster.
And in terms, though, of you just pointed out that the Democrats would lose a Senate seat if Elizabeth Warren were to be made the vice president because of the Republican governor. The same applies, of course, in the state of Ohio, where Sherrod Brown is often mentioned as a possible VP. And Kasich, the Republican governor, would replace him with a Republican. But when you just, as you just said then, Peter Dreier, about what Bernie's going to possibly and likely be doing for Hillary Clinton, which is a heavy lift, some serious campaigning, he would most likely want to stay in the Senate, would he not, and win back the Senate, which they have a chance of because of Donald Trump's down ticket damage, and he would end up being the chair of the important budget committee.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he'll have an enormous amount of power if the Democrats take back the Senate, and he'll know how to use it. He'll be hiring, you know, lots of new staff people for the budget committee, a lot of progressive economists from all the think tanks and universities. He'll be able to hold hearings all over the country on key issues about, you know, almost any issue the budget committee touches, including, you know, voter registration, the military budget, and the anti-poverty safety net, and the minimum wage. So he could really help to build a real infrastructure just through the budget committee. But on top of that, he needs to, and I think his supporters need understand they need to build some kind of organization or network that the Bernie may be the titular head of, but he's not going to run on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, as you know, there's going to be a conference in Chicago next week of a lot of Bernie's supporters thinking, where do we go next to keep the momentum going? And so as chair of the budget committee, as the sort of leader of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, along with Elizabeth Warren, and as the leader of, you know, a grassroots movement that brought together people on all kinds of issues. And I think one of the things that's missing from the conversation about this election is that Bernie won the victory of ideas, in part because of all the grassroots movements of the last several years, from Occupy Wall Street to Black Lives Matter to the campaign against fossil fuels to the campaign for the Dreamers campaign on immigration reform. All these grassroots movements, are, you know, radical and protest-oriented, but their ideas got injected into this presidential campaign and will get injected into the House and Senate campaigns. And so they deserve a lot of credit, too. I mean, Bernie was their voice in many ways, but it was all that protest and activism that's been going on around the country that's really changed the way Americans think about the 1% and race and gender and immigration and lots of other issues. If you look at the public opinion polls, more Americans agree with Bernie Sanders than they do with Hillary Clinton in terms of these issues.
And lately, Peter Dreyer, I've been looking into the possibility that Donald Trump, as we know, as I think and many do, that he entered the race to improve his brand and to boost the Trump brand, which is all he is, basically. He's a brand. He sort of got ahead of him, and he suddenly doesn't know what to do with himself and may well be looking for an exit because he's clearly in chaos. His campaign is in chaos. When we talk about down ticket damage that he would do, all of the scenarios that you just talked about won't happen, or would be less likely to happen if a white knight came in replacing Trump on the Republican side. That's not necessarily that may be a fanciful scenario, but you know, there's the even talking Senator Kirk's even talking about drafting David Petraeus, etc. I guess he'll get the infidelity vote, right?
So, a couple of months ago, I wrote a couple of articles saying that that Paul Ryan was waiting in the wings for a brokered convention. Right. That if none of the candidates got enough delegates, that he'd come in as the savior. In many ways, Paul Ryan is to the right of Trump. He's not as obnoxious. He's a better looking candidate in terms of not saying overtly racist things. But he'd be a disaster as president. But I do think the Democrats will do better with Trump, and I think a lot of the Republican leaders realize that, but they don't quite know what to do. I mean, Trump is the Frankenstein that the Republican Party and their big buck leaders like the Koch brothers, who won't endorse him but created the monster in the first place. They don't know what to do now because they've created this monster and he's got a life, so to speak, of his own. And he's saying all these outrageous things, and lots of Republican leaders some are disavowing him, some are distancing him, some are actually unendorsing him. But it's hard to imagine a scenario at the Republican convention. They'd have to dramatically change the rules where they can deny him the nomination and allow someone like Paul Ryan, who I think is the most likely to step in from waiting in the wings and become the nominee. He said he doesn't want it, but that's what he said about being Speaker. So I think he'd be the most likely person to jump into the breach, but I don't think Republicans know how to do that without alienating so many people that it would even be worse in some ways for the party. But it's wonderful to watch the Republican Party implode in front of our eyes. And it's well deserved because they created this disaster, and now they're bearing the fruit.
So the dog whistle has now become a siren, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what's amazing is how juvenile, narcissistic, just blatantly racist Trump is, and how the Republicans don't know how to handle that because he won't. Listen to them. He won't follow their discipline. Even the other night when he gave his victory speech and he was for the first time reading from a teleprompter, which he clearly felt uncomfortable doing, which was why his speech was so boring, he couldn't help himself. He was trying to be disciplined. He was trying to be presidential. And then somebody in the audience made a mistake. Instead of saying the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, he said somebody shouted out PPP. And what does Trump do? He makes a joke about PP. He makes a toilet joke in the middle of his victory speech. He's clearly got impulse, control problems, as well as being a racist and a sexual predator. And he doesn't know how to handle himself. And, unless they keep him in Trump Tower and he campaigns from his office, he's going to have to be out there giving interviews and talking to people. This is going to happen numerous times. So on the one hand, I'd like to say that, that whoever the Democrats run, whether it were Hillary or Bernie, although it's going to be Hillary, they would win in a landslide because Trump is such a disaster. But you never know, and so I think we can't rest easy and pretend that Trump doesn't have a following. But I just think in the next couple months, if he continues to be the nominee, which I think he will, there'll be such a meltdown. It'll be historic.
Well, Peter Dreyer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Dreyer, who is the E.P. Clapp Distinguished Professor of Politics and Chair of the Urban Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College. His latest book is The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Let Bernie Be Hillary. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into whether or not Donald Trump actually has a presidential campaign.
Some people try and treat me like a man. Yeah, some people try and treat me like a man. Well, I guess they just don't understand. Yeah, some people try and treat me like a man. They think I know, but that's just it. I'm a child.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Graham, a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National. And his latest article at The Atlantic is There Is No Trump Campaign. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Graham.
Thank you.
And the fact that there's no Trump campaign may fit into a broader context of other dysfunctions, if you will, that are certainly being argued about, and a lot of prominent Republicans have come forth, some like Lindsey Graham saying that Trump or the Republicans should be looking for an off-ramp to get rid of him. Senator Kirk, running in Illinois, absolutely slammed the door on him and wants nothing to do with him. And Senator Jeff Flake in Arizona is talking about contesting him at the convention. But just in that context, I take it that Trump's justification for having a small, if not a non-existent campaign, is to do with the fact that the Trump Organization does have small staff, because it's basically a franchising operation where Trump sells the right to use his names to a developer, and then they do all the work. And in fact, an early tweet of Trump said, I'm getting bad marks from certain pundits because I have a small campaign staff, but small is good, flexible, save money, and number one. Of course, now he's deleted that tweet. So let's start from that premise. Is this a virtue or just another example of the dysfunction of the Trump campaign?
I think it's mostly a function of the dysfunction of the Trump campaign. You know, you look at the sort of things that we're talking about. Not really a state-level organization in some of the most important states, places like Ohio. Focus on places like New York, an inability to respond quickly to attacks from rivals, and no fundraising. You know, Trump thinks he can replace a lot of these things with his social media prowess and earned media, but it's just hard to believe you can replace everything that a presidential campaign does with a Twitter account.
But can he outsource it, as he apparently wants to do, to the RNC, the Republican National Committee?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, there are things you definitely can outsource to the RNC, and I think some of the coverage of this has been a little bit credulous in attacking the idea that Trump has no ground game. You know, 4 years ago, Mitt Romney also allowed the RNC to basically run his ground game. That may not have gone so well, but the idea is not crazy. It is, however, pretty questionable to not have any state-level organization, not to have staffers on the ground in major swing states. There's also a problem not to be raising a lot of money. And he claims he's outsourcing that to the RNC too, but if you look at the numbers and you look at what his fundraising committee is saying, they admit they've barely done anything, and they say they're not going to raise anywhere near the $1 billion he once promised he'd raise.
Well, the people with the best ground game, from my understanding, on the Republican side are the Koch brothers. They've got the database, don't they? And isn't Trump or Lewandowski used to work for a branch of the Koch brothers' operations that was otherwise known as the Octopus? He was one of the tentacles, I guess, he worked for. So what's the story there? Do you think that meeting that's supposed to be taking place, I think, is it Trump that's going to meet with the Koch brothers or Lewandowski? Do you know the details on that?
It's unclear exactly what the state of that is. And, you know, so far they've been very hands-off, and they've suggested that Hillary Clinton would be bad, but maybe no worse than Trump. And they've basically said, at this point, they're saying they're going to stay out of the presidential race. So you have him being unable, through the things he said and the sort of the people he's alienated, to take advantage of these resources that they have.
So they're just going to focus on the Senate and the House, which is, of course, that's where the concern is for down-ticket damage because of Trump.
Exactly. They're saying they want to mitigate that damage and focus on those races instead rather than throwing money after Trump, who I think a lot of Republicans have, rightly or wrongly, already written off as sure to lose.
Well, do you think that's a self-reinforcing situation where the more the assumption is he's going to lose, the less the donors are going to open up their checkbook and the less the RNC is going to put out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and you look at something like Trump talking about how he's going to go hard on New York, and he thinks he's going to be able to win New York. If you're a major donor, do you really want to invest money in a guy who's saying outrageous things, who isn't clearly a conservative on a lot of issues, and also is talking about spending money in ways that seem fairly fantastic? Probably you don't.
Yeah, well, I think the donors are reasonably sophisticated. They know that Hillary Clinton's got pretty much a lock on New York, right? I mean,
right.
You don't have to be a political pundit to figure that one out. So just to wind back a little bit, David, recently I had Sid Blumenthal on talking about his new book on Abraham Lincoln, The Self-Made Man, and he made the comment that Trump is the dog that caught the fire truck. And we discussed that a little bit where he made the case and others, and I made the case that it, and by the way, President Obama did at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, that Trump entered the race as a branding exercise to improve his brand, and it sort of got away from him, and he couldn't believe the response he got, I think, which is similar to Bernie Sanders. I think he was surprised by the extraordinary outpouring of support that he galvanized. So it's sort of like maybe the guy doesn't really want this job, or any sort of trapped, and maybe even looking for an exit.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I've been hearing people talking about this possibility more and more for, you know, very quietly at first, and then more over the last few weeks. And it's hard to find any hard evidence in favor of it. But circumstantially, you can see why people buy it. You know, Trump is now in a position of being the nominee of a party, and he's unwilling to do any of the things that nominees do. He's unwilling to court donors. He's unwilling to sort of, you know, speak to a more moderate audience. He's unwilling to build a staff and build a ground operation. Those are the sort of things you expect from somebody who doesn't really want to be running.
But on the other hand, maybe he's saying, look, I've got this far on my own instincts, and as Frank Sinatra would say, I did it my way, you know. So do you think
exactly.
Is that the way he sees it? That, you know, you guys...
That seems to be the way he sees it.
And frankly, you know...
You know, he's got...
Go ahead.
He's got this Twitter account. He's got a huge audience from it. He got us all this attention during the primary, and I think he imagines it's going to go just that way for the general election. Not having run a campaign before, I think he maybe doesn't have a great understanding of what the sort of money you raise does and what the ground game does. But he has, you know, all of his political experience is the primary, and he just absolutely destroyed a bunch of rivals who are much more experienced and, on paper, better qualified. So you can see why he'd think, well, I'll just do that again and it'll work fine for me.
But the other side of it is that you've got this character who may or may not have wanted to be president. He may have wanted to win the presidency, but not necessarily take on the job. Or indeed, he did want to just improve his brand, didn't think he would win like Dr. Carson, obviously, was all about selling his books. He, in fact, went on a book tour in the middle of his campaign. So that's not unheard of, people entering political races for public relations and business reasons to improve their visibility. But let's just deal with what I understand is the day-to-day situation here, that Donald Trump is holed up in Trump Tower. He's got Hope Hicks, his press person, and Lewandowski beside him, essentially barking orders at them. He's on Twitter all day long and watching cable news and occasionally having a meltdown and calling up journalists. That's the picture that I'm getting of this guy. That's not a picture of a candidate running for national office.
Absolutely not. And you see this in things like, you know, Hillary Clinton delivered the big speech assailing him, and Trump tweeted in response to it, of course, and then he was mostly silent for several days. He kind of replied Tuesday night in his victory speech, but he says he's really going to give his response on Monday. So we're looking at almost 2 weeks between a major speech, which got a lot of press and was very damaging to Trump, and his response. You know, that's just not the kind of agility and readiness that one expects from a presidential candidate.
So do you think that there's a subtext to this disquiet being expressed by these senior Republican figures like Paul Ryan, like Mitch McConnell, like Lindsey Graham and Senators Kirk and Flake, that it's not just about this racist insults to this judge, that there's something else that they're concerned about, that the dysfunction, in other words?
Right. You expect the presidential nominee to sort of be the spirit of the party and to keep these things going. You mentioned the down-ballot races, and those down-ballot candidates are going to be hurt by racist remarks, but they're also going to be hurt if Trump doesn't have the organization to turn out votes and identify voters, all the sort of things that drive turnout down the ballot. And so they're looking at a position in a place where they're really in a bad way if they have a candidate this bad at the top of the ticket, whether it's organizationally or just rhetorically.
And is it true that Paul Manafort, who was hired fairly recently, simply is in an alternative universe, that he sends strategy suggestions and strategy papers over to Trump Tower and Lewandowski tears them up or throws them in the trash? I mean, that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, well, it seems like there's a bit of a tug of war. There are weeks and days when Manafort seems to be winning and ideas he has come to the fore, and then there are weeks when Lewandowski is on top and things that Manafort says get tossed out. It's not even behind the scenes, too. I mean, you see Manafort going out and making statements in public, whether on television or, for example, to Republican senators, and then Trump will promptly turn around and contradict them just publicly. So you see him being undercut in that way, and it, you know, happens all the time.
So what's the latest then with Dick Morris, who is this sort of reptilian lobbyist operator who somehow inveigled his way into the Clinton White House and then had a huge falling out with Clinton and then went across to Fox News and became one of the most sort of venomous commentators on the Clintons. And now there's some talk that Trump's going to hire him. Not sure whether he'll end up the same as Manafort, but what do you hear on that?
Well, so the Morris thing is fascinating. You know, he's been writing this column for The Hill for the last few years. He was predicting ahead of the Romney-Obama election wide margins for Romney, you know, just very confidently asserting that it was going to be not close at all. And we know how that turned out. He recently got hired by the National Enquirer as their chief political correspondent, which is a title
chief,
I did not know existed.
Chief political? Are you kidding?
Dead serious. And frankly, given the accuracy of the things he's been writing, the National Enquirer might be the right place for him to be.
Right.
And the National Enquirer has been very friendly to Trump. You know, it's run repeated stories that cast aspersions on Trump's rivals. The CEO is a good friend of Trump's going back many years, so that's already sort of in the alliance. New York Magazine reported that Morris was in talks to join the Trump campaign. The Trump campaign says that's not true. But even if he doesn't join formally, I mean, sort of that perch at National Enquirer might serve as a kind of propagandist role for the Trump campaign.
Oh, so a headless woman found in a topless bar. Somehow it's going to morph into a political headline. Stay tuned. So what then do you think the professionals are going to do? I mean, you can see that, for example, Bernie Sanders hired Tad Devine, who, by the way, worked with Manafort. So, you know, that fraternity of these consultants is more about, you know, money than about, you know, ideological allegiance. But they, and I'm sure a lot of them want to keep these campaigns going because they want the checks to keep being cut. But the fact that everybody else has hired all these people and Trump has hired them, but he's not using them, and Lewandowski is a real neophyte. I think he's only run the Koch brothers operation in New Hampshire, isn't it? That's the extent of his political experience. And he already got in a lot of
trouble. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and he got in a lot of trouble already, didn't he, with roughing up that woman from, I think, from Breitbart, wasn't she? Although she's a little off the wall herself, so it's hard to know what happened there. So where, I guess my question is, where will the adult supervision come from?
I think hope springs eternal that either some of these guys will get in and they'll start talking sense into Trump and he'll come around, or that, you know, maybe Trump wins, and once he wins, then he has to fill out a White House staff, and then he's going to have to hire adults who will show him the way. And so you have these establishment Republicans thinking, well, maybe at some point he's going to get it. Maybe he understands. If we complain enough, he'll get it. And failing that, you know, we want to make sure there are adults around him in a White House so that he can't go totally off the rails. But I think they don't feel comfortable totally abandoning him. They can't just absolutely let go of it and let him run off the rails and not have any connection at all because of the damage that he can do to the party and to candidates down ballot. So they're really in a tough bind.
So I guess the issue over vice president, which he's now talking about, seems to also be sort of surrounded by a certain amount of dysfunction, because a lot of the names that have been floated have pulled out. And then one of them, of course, Newt Gingrich, is now, because he criticized Trump's racist comments vis-a-vis the judge, Trump got mad at him on that. Trump now says he's got a list of, I think, three of whom are politicians, well-known, he says, and two of whom are former military giants. Of course, the other name that's been floated around as a white knight, if they can somehow ease Trump out of the picture, is David Petraeus. I can't remember who floated his idea that if they can get rid of Trump, then maybe they could put Petraeus in. Maybe.
Mark Kirk says he's going to write Petraeus in.
That's who it came from. Okay.
Yeah.
Mark Kirk, that's right, the senator from Illinois who's in a tough race, a Republican. Yeah, he's the guy that's where that came from. So do you have any insight into who these military giants are? If they're anything like Trump's foreign policy team, then it's going to be a joke.
Yeah, I don't. And the foreign policy team is an interesting case where the names came out and the people who are experts in each of those fields sort of reacted by saying, huh? Who are these guys? So it's hard to know who he's talking about. I also, frankly, find it hard to take very seriously what he is telling us about his list now, simply because the number of names on the list has fluctuated wildly, and the people on the list have fluctuated. So, you know, you have Trump saying, oh, Susana Martinez of New Mexico is on my list. She's a great leader. A week later, she skips a rally that he's attending, and he talks about how she's not doing her job. A few days after that, he says she's great and he wants her endorsement. So really, his opinion about people seems to shift from day to day, making it hard to know whether when he says these things, this list is really final, or if it's just the people who came to the top of his head when somebody asked him.
Well, David Graham, all I can say is we should stay in touch.
Because lots more to talk about.
Lots more to talk about. And I'm grateful for your being there in Washington, D.C., trying to figure out what these people are up to, and I appreciate it. Thanks.
All right. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with David Graham, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National, and his latest article at The Atlantic is There Is No Trump Campaign. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Bernie Sanders' remarks at the White House today, where he called for statehood for the District of Columbia, which has more citizens in it than his state of Vermont.
From the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Anise Jenkins, who is the executive director of the Stand Up for Democracy in D.C. Coalition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anise Jenkins.
Thank you so much for including this issue and including me in your conversation.
Well, I think in many ways, of course, this has been a longstanding disgrace that the nation's capital, the people who live there, 600,000 American citizens, don't have the rights that the rest of us have. But Bernie Sanders, after he met with President Obama today in the White House, brought up the fact that he's campaigning for the D.C. primary next Tuesday, but he's going to make an issue out of statehood for D.C. So I guess that gives you some heart, right?
Absolutely. We need exposure. We need people to know. And on a national level, it's extremely important because the only way, according to the U.S. Constitution, the only way that we can become a state is for the United States Congress to approve any bill that we introduce for statehood. So national exposure is just wonderful, just amazing.
But clearly, though, this is a Republican-controlled Congress, and I imagine for purely partisan reasons, they don't want to give Washington, D.C. statehood because that will likely mean two more Democratic senators, and they already have a House Democrat, but she, of course, really can't vote. So that would certainly add one more House member and two, and more importantly, two Senate members. Is that at the heart of the reason why the Republicans have resisted this for so long?
Well, I am sure that has a lot to do with it, although Republicans and conservatives present themselves as being supporters of self-determination, of self-government, of separation from controls of the federal government. So it's rather ironic that they would use a partisan reason to keep us from what the principles they present as being their principles. However, you know, I guess we have to realize that sometimes parties don't particularly go according to their own rules and positions. There are four reasons, and this has been longstanding. First, stated by Senator Edward Kennedy, who introduced our first statehood bill. The four twos, we were said to be too liberal, and we are very, very, very progressive. Too liberal, too black, too urban, and too Democrat. And I guess if you want to use those as reasons to keep almost 700,000 people who pay the highest federal taxes per person in the country from having their just due, their full citizenship rights, I guess you could choose to do that, which the Congress does have the power to make that selection, but it is totally reprehensible, absolutely reprehensible.
Well, Bernie Sanders pointed out today at the White House after meeting with President Obama that his state, Vermont, and the state of Wyoming have similar populations numbers, if not even smaller, than
That's
the District
correct.
Of Columbia. And there are
That's
about 10 more other states that have very low populations that are comparable. So this is really appears to be deeply unfair.
It is extremely unfair, and it's an international disgrace. We have had members of our organization travel to Geneva to go to the United Nations Human Rights Committee, and they paid their own money to do this, to have the United States Human Rights Commission, which has condemned the United States for not letting the residents of its capital have the rights that everyone else has. In fact, the United States is the only nation in the world that has a democratic form of government where the people can vote in a Congress. It is the only country in the world does not let its residents have representation. It's the only one. And it stands out. It's very stark. It should be an embarrassment. We say around the world that we are a beacon of democracy, yet we have almost 750,000 people who are totally shut out of the democratic small d process. And it is an embarrassment. The OAS, Organization of American States, has also condemned the United States for this. Many international bodies around the world have pointed this out. Even, I believe, China at one time said it was quite ironic that the United States was criticizing their lack of democracy, whereas the people in the very capital of the U.S. were suffering from a lack of democracy. So it's no defense. It's absolutely no defense. If we have to change into a Republican, bipartisan city to get our rights, that's undemocratic. We should be able to vote the way we want. We should be able to select the people who represent us. We should not have 535 people who are in the United States House and Representatives threatening to arrest our mayor and our city council for defying some of the things that the United States Congress has imposed upon us. This is absurd. It's absolutely absurd and embarrassing.
So tell us about what your representative, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, can actually do. Is it sort of a ceremonial job? Or is she the chief executive of the city? She doesn't have voting rights, so it's a rather peculiar position to hold, isn't it? She gets...
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is. She is equivalent to any delegate from the territories. However, there is a major difference. The territories do not pay federal taxes, and we pay the highest. Delegates do not have a vote on the House floor. They can serve as even chairs of committees in the House. They can vote in committee. They can introduce legislation, but they are prohibited from having any final vote on the House floor on any legislation. So she has introduced the New Columbia Admissions Act, which is a bill to admit D.C. As the 51st state into the United States. However, if it comes to a vote, she wouldn't have the ability to vote on it, and neither would the other delegates from territories. It's just a really ironic situation. And she has been judged by some of the publications that judge the activity of Congress people. She's been judged as one of the most powerful as far as comparing it to the little power that she actually does have. We do have an elected council. We do have an elected mayor. We didn't get these until the 1970s when Lyndon Johnson created D.C. or regarded us as a federal department where he could reorganize it as president. We didn't have an elected school board. As I said, we did not have an elected mayor or city council, and D.C. residents could not vote for president until 1974. The first president that D.C. residents could vote for was Lyndon Johnson. Really incredible. And I'm sure most people around the country are not aware at all of this oppression right in the nation's capital.
Well, you mentioned earlier, Anise Jenkins, again, the executive director of the Stand Up for Democracy in D.C. Coalition, that Bernie Sanders gave you a boost today speaking outside of the White House after having met with President Obama. He said that he was going to campaign for D.C. statehood in his campaign for the Tuesday primary, the last primary of the entire country in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. Now, also today, Bernie Sanders held a rally at RFK Stadium where he reiterated his call for D.C. statehood. So tell me about how your organization works, and mm-hmm. what kind of strategies can you develop given the fact that this is so nakedly partisan that the Republicans just simply will not allow D.C. statehood because they don't want two more Democratic senators in the Senate, and they don't want the D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton to be able to vote. So does it really come down to, Anise, at the end of the day, the Democrats have got to take back the House and the Senate?
Well, I would just love to say that. And Stand Up for Democracy is a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, because we truly do believe, despite the fact that we are being regarded as partisan as a city and perhaps as a future state, we see this issue as totally nonpartisan. It's about the United States stepping up and honoring the principles that started the country, taxation without representation. He has done a great service to us by making this a national issue and giving it exposure. I do have to say that Hillary Clinton has confirmed that she also supports statehood for the District of Columbia. And surprisingly enough, when Trump first announced that he was going to run, Meet the Press, someone asked him on Meet the Press that he supports statehood. And he said, oh, yes, I support statehood. And he kind of took it back, I guess, when somebody pulled him aside and said what statehood was. I don't think he actually knew what he was agreeing to. But our strategy is to do our educational outreach locally, regionally, and nationally. We have documentaries that we've sent around the world and sent around the nation. We contact civil rights organizations to get on their agenda as far as promotion. One of the major strategies that we use is education, because people simply don't know. We did a poll on the National Mall about 3 years ago, and we found out that 73% of the visitors from all over the world had no idea. But once they heard about our plight, our lack of democracy in the Capitol, they immediately said they support it. This is just, people just don't know. It's just so strange and so unusual. When they find out, they give a tremendous amount of support. And one thing we would like to ask the people who are listening is to don't forget about the people, the 700,000 people in Washington, D.C. Please appeal to your congressman. Please appeal to your representatives. Please let your teachers know, you know, that they need to educate the children, and let them really promote and understand the severe oppression that we are living under in Washington, D.C. We need that outreach, and your program is really helping us get the word out, and I appreciate it so much.
Well, it's a pleasure to help you in any way I can, Anise Jenkins, and of course it is a enduring shame that the residents of the capital of the United States do not have the democratic rights that the rest of the country has. And as you've pointed out, and as Bernie Sanders pointed out today at the White House after meeting with President Obama, his state of Vermont, its population is around 625,000, which is less than the population of Washington, D.C. And of course, the state of Wyoming's population is 586,107, which is way below Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And your point, of course, is well taken, that you are a nonprofit, IRS exempt 501c3, which means you can educate but not advocate, and that puts you in a bind. But nevertheless, without forcing you to taking any partisan position, the reality is it not, that the Republicans have persistently opposed D.C. statehood, and that the Democrats have, as you mentioned, both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have advocated it?
That's correct. That is the history. That's the truth. And we don't have to hide from the truth, and we won't. But I would like to say also that we were on the Democratic statehood. D.C. statehood was part of the Democratic platform until, I would say, the 1990s. For some reason, and I'm not quite clear why, we were taken off the Democratic platform. So I do really say that we, because we have voted so strongly for Democrats, we need to be repaid by if the House or the Senate and the presidency are back in Democratic hands, we need to be repaid. We need to be acknowledged, and we need to be supported. Put that back on the Democratic platform. And Republicans, put it on your platform, too, because you are being totally hypocritical if you say you are for local government, less federal control, yet you let 535 people rule the District of Columbia, rule over 700,000 people. That's hypocrisy at its height.
Well, just in closing, Anise Jenkins, what are the clashes that the mayor has had with this Republican House?
Well, we voted 82% to control our own local budget. Now, this is not money that was given to D.C. from the federal government. This is money that comes out of our pocket that the D.C. Council passes and decides what our local taxes will be used for. We had Mark Meadows, a representative Republican from North Carolina, within the last 2 months, introduce a bill to repeal our local referendum. And he is one of the people who has threatened that if the D.C. government does not, because the budget, our laws, everything have to go to the Congress for approval. They have a 30-day layover on the Hill for anything that our local government does. So our local government recently decided to ignore that and to send the money, the part of the budget that is federal only, to be approved. And our local budget has gone through, and Mark Meadows and others on the Hill, and they are members of the Tea Party, they're leaders in the Tea Party also, have threatened to arrest our mayor and our council. This is absolutely absurd. Also, we voted for medical marijuana, and Bob Barr at that time was head of one of our committees on the Hill. He's from Georgia. He's not in the Congress anymore, but he was from Georgia, and he took our funding from our Board of Elections and Ethics and would not let us know what the vote on our initiative was for a year. This was just like what happened with Al Gore. The votes could not be counted. We are constantly disrespected, discriminated against, and shown that we are not true citizens of the United States of America. Until we are a state, statehood will give us the protection that we need from congressional interference on our local decisions. Well, and we hope that people around the country will appeal to their representatives to vote for that legislation that's on the Hill.
Well, Anise Jenkins, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you so much. And our website is freedc.org. Thank you so much.
freedc.org. And again, Anise Jenkins is Executive Director of the Stand Up for Democracy in D.C. Coalition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the